All right, so today we're going to do a deep dive into something pretty fundamental to any organization that wants to, well, actually grow and succeed.
Yeah, for sure.
We're cracking open the handbook of personnel development.
Big handbook.
Yeah, a big one. And we're going to be going chapter by chapter.
Oh, well.
So to kick things off, we're starting right at the beginning with chapter one.
Makes sense.
It's titled Structure and Strategy of Personnel Development, which sounds kind of
A
formal.
little bit, yeah.
But honestly, it's like the blueprint for how companies should be thinking about developing their people.
Yeah, it really gets at those core ideas.
And it's not just about like throwing together some training programs, it's a much more strategic approach.
Definitely, it's about taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture.
Right. From the get-go, the chapter jumps into competency model.
Competency models, yeah.
I feel like sometimes that phrase can sound a bit jargony.
It can, a little bit, yeah.
But really, it's just about figuring out what skills and abilities people need to have to be successful in a company.
It's about defining what good looks like, essentially.
Exactly. And the chapter makes it clear that these models aren't only for development, they're important for like all aspects of HR.
Absolutely, from hiring to promotions, even figuring out compensation.
It's like having the shared language across the entire organization.
Right, a common understanding of what's valued and what's needed.
So you're not just, winging it when you're making decisions about people.
No, you have a solid framework to base those decisions on.
And what I found really interesting is how the chapter emphasizes that a competency-based learning culture is really about understanding how adults learn best.
Yeah, it's not just about delivering information. It's about creating an environment that motivates people to develop new skills.
Yeah, it's about tapping into that intrinsic drive we all have to learn and grow.
And the cool thing is, this isn't just theory. The chapter even highlights a study from way back in 2005.
Oh, wow, 2005.
Yeah, at this place called RWTH-Aachen.
I can't say that.
No, me neither. But anyway, one of the authors was actually involved in this research.
Oh, cool.
And it was all about evaluating how well competency models worked in real companies, in the field.
So they actually saw it in action.
They did. They got to see firsthand how these models could be put into practice and what the results were.
That's always so much more convincing than just hypothetical ideas, right?
Totally. Seeing how it plays out in the real world.
And this brings us to a really central idea in the chapter, which is that modern personal development, it's not just about, like I said, putting on training courses.
Right.
It's about this much broader idea of developing and managing competencies strategically.
Yeah, it's about recognizing that competencies are these valuable assets that need to be nurtured and leveraged.
Absolutely. Like you said, it's not just about having the knowledge and skills, it's about actually using them to achieve business goals.
And this is where it gets interesting because the chapter actually brings up a pretty critical perspective.
Oh.
Yeah, there's this guy, Manfred Becker,
Manfred Becker.
who actually suggested, and this is kind of radical, that maybe we should just stop using the term competency altogether.
Wow, just ditch it.
Yeah, like get rid of it. Gone.
That's a pretty strong statement. I'm curious to hear why he felt that way.
Well, from what the chapter explains, it seems like his main concern was that the way organizations actually define and use competency models can be really, well, kind of messy.
Like, not very consistent.
Exactly. There can be a lot of ambiguity and different
Like,
interpretations.
what does communication really mean?
Right, or leadership can mean so many different things to different people.
So he felt like the term was just causing more confusion than clarity.
I think that was part of his argument, yeah.
But the chapter also makes this really practical point,
Okay, what's
which is that competency, like it or not, is such a widely used term now
it is, it's everywhere.
that even if you wanted to get rid of it, it's probably not going to happen.
No, it's too ingrained in the HR vocabulary at this point.
It's like trying to change the meaning of a word that everyone already uses in a certain way.
Exactly, even if there isn't a perfect consensus on what it means.
So it's this kind of ongoing challenge, right?
Yeah, we have to acknowledge the limitations of the term, but also recognize that it's here to stay.
So we got to work with it.
We do.
The chapter also points to some really compelling research.
Oh, tell me about it.
It mentions a study by the Federal Ministry for Research and Education in Germany.
Okay, and what did they find?
This study ran from 1999 to 2002.
Okay.
And they found that the companies that were really dynamic, like the ones that were growing quickly and adapting to change, those were the companies that were investing heavily in their employees' skills.
It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy almost. You invest in your people and they help you grow and adapt even more.
Exactly. It creates this positive feedback loop.
Yeah, it shows that focusing on people's competencies is directly linked to business success.
And this is a message that any leader should pay attention to, right?
Absolutely. If you want your organization to thrive, you gotta invest in your people.
And at the end of the day, the chapter makes it very clear that the value companies get from developing their employees' competencies,
Yeah.
it's undeniable, even if it's hard to put an exact number on it.
Right. It's one of those things you just know is important, even if it's not always easy to measure precisely.
It's like trying to calculate the ROI on, I don't know, employee morale.
Exactly. You can see the impact, but it's hard to quantify.
But that doesn't mean it's not valuable.
Absolutely not. It's crucial.
The chapter does mention a guideline from the Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Labor
Okay.
about creating something called knowledge balance sheets.
Knowledge balance sheets. Interesting.
Yeah, it's basically an attempt to try to assess this less tangible impact of knowledge and competencies.
That's a really interesting idea, like trying to put a value on the intangible.
Exactly. Because it is an asset, even if it's not a physical one.
For sure, it's a key driver of innovation and growth.
So the chapter then kind of zooms out a little bit
Okay.
and starts talking about how a company's overall business strategy and the external environment
Right.
all play a role in shaping how they approach personnel development.
It's about recognizing that personnel development doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's influenced by all these other factors.
And the chapter really emphasizes that companies are operating in these super complex and constantly changing markets.
Yeah, it's like trying to navigate a jungle gym that's always shifting and moving.
Exactly. You can't just predict what's going to happen next. You have to be able to adapt.
And that means having a deep understanding of how strategic thinking works in these complex systems.
And it's not just about having one person in the company who's the strategy expert.
No, it needs to be embedded throughout the organization.
It's a mindset, right?
Yeah, a way of thinking about the world and the future.
The chapter even mentions some data from way back, like 1989 and 1995.
Okay, ancient history.
I know, right? But they were looking at how far ahead big companies were planning back then.
Interesting. And what did they find?
They found that strategic thinking has become way more prominent in recent years.
So companies are thinking further ahead now.
Yeah, which makes sense when you think about how much faster the world is changing now.
Totally. You have to be able to anticipate and adapt to change if you want to survive.
The chapter also notes that later on it'll dive deeper into how specific personnel development tools align with these broader strategies.
Oh, so that's something to look forward to.
Definitely, it'll be interesting to see how it all connects.
For
But
sure.
then, and this is a big one, the chapter really gets into the digital agenda of HR.
The digital agenda, yeah.
It even includes a whole figure outlining the key themes.
That's helpful.
Figure five, for those who are following along.
Got it.
And some of these themes are, well, they're not surprising, but they're super important,
Like what?
like consumer orientation.
Consumer orientation. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's basically about treating employees like internal customers.
So focusing on their needs and experiences.
Exactly, making sure they're engaged and satisfied.
That makes sense, especially in today's competitive job market.
Then there's workforce analytics,
Workforce analytics, yeah.
which is all about using data to make better decisions about people.
Oh, so using data to drive HR strategy.
Exactly. It's about moving away from gut feelings and relying on evidence.
I like that. Data-driven decisions.
And then there's the reorganization of work,
Reorganization of work, yeah.
which is about how technology is changing job roles and team structures.
It's about adapting to the new ways of working.
Exactly. Things like remote work, flexible schedules, all that.
It's a whole new world of work out there.
There's also digital learning, which is a no-brainer these days.
Yeah, online courses, virtual training, it's becoming the norm.
And skills management, which is so crucial because the skills that are in demand are constantly evolving.
You got to stay ahead of the curve.
And even leadership in network organizations, which reflects the fact that companies are becoming more fluid and collaborative.
It's not just about top-down leadership anymore.
Yeah, no, it's about empowering people at all levels to lead and contribute.
And the chapter really stresses that this whole digital shift, it's not just about technology.
It's about people too, right?
Exactly. HR professionals need to have the skills and competencies to navigate this new landscape.
You got to be digitally savvy.
Absolutely. They need to be comfortable with technology and able to use it effectively.
And they need to be able to lead and support their organizations through this transition.
It's a big responsibility, but also a really exciting opportunity.
Definitely. It's a chance to shape the future of work.
For sure.
So the chapter then moves on to talk about knowledge management and talent management.
Two more big topics.
Huge topics. And it starts by focusing on the foundation, which is knowledge itself.
Yeah, knowledge is power, as they say.
The chapter emphasizes that knowledge is the starting point for developing someone's ability to actually do something, to take action.
It's the raw material, the building blocks.
It even references the knowledge staircase.
Oh, what's that?
It's this model by a guy named North Motanus. And it basically shows how data becomes information, then knowledge, and ultimately wisdom.
So it's like a hierarchy of knowledge.
Yeah, and each level builds on the one before it.
Makes sense.
And the way organizations approach knowledge management has changed a lot over time.
Oh, I bet it has.
The chapter points out that back in the 90s, the focus was really on technology.
So like building databases and intranets.
Exactly. It was all about creating systems for storing and sharing information.
Like those early knowledge management platforms.
Yeah, but then there was this shift towards recognizing the human element of knowledge management.
Oh, so not just focusing on the technology, but on the people who hold the knowledge.
Exactly, because so much of our knowledge is tacit. It's not written down anywhere.
It's the stuff we know how to do.
Yeah.
But we might not even be able to explain it.
Like riding a bike, you just do it.
Right. You don't think about all the individual steps involved.
And the chapter connects this evolution of knowledge management to the rise of the knowledge society.
Yeah, the knowledge society.
The increasing use of social networking and collaboration.
People are more connected than ever before.
And of course, the ongoing digitalization of everything.
It's all part of this larger trend.
The ultimate goal of knowledge management, according to the chapter, is to help organizations thrive in this constantly changing environment.
So it's about adapting and evolving.
It's about fostering continuous learning, driving innovation, and encouraging reflection.
And ultimately empowering employees to act effectively.
Which ties back to competency development, right?
Full circle.
Knowledge is the foundation.
The bedrock.
So then we get to talent management.
Talent management, another big one.
A chapter first defines what talent actually means.
Okay, because that word gets thrown around a lot.
It does, and it can mean different things.
So what's the definition here?
They actually give two definitions.
Two, okay.
First, it's an inherent ability or aptitude that allows someone to be exceptional in something.
So the potential to be great.
Exactly, but then it's also the individual who possesses that ability.
So the person themselves.
So it's both the potential and the person.
Interesting. Two sides of the same coin.
And the link to personnel development is that it's about understanding and nurturing the individual skills and potential of employees.
So recognizing that everyone has their own unique strengths and development needs.
Exactly. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach.
And talent management, as the chapter outlines, is this really comprehensive approach.
It's not just one thing.
No, it's a whole set of strategies and methods.
For identifying, attracting, developing, positioning, and retaining high potential individuals.
So it's about the entire employee life cycle.
It's a long-term strategic view.
Not just a quick fix.
And it considers both internal employees and external candidates.
So it's about building a strong talent pipeline.
It's interesting because it sounds a lot like competency management in a way.
Yeah. How so?
They're both about making sure the organization has the right people with the right skills in the right roles.
But with a different focus, maybe.
Yeah. Competency management is more about the skills themselves, while talent management is more about the individuals who possess those skills.
So it's like a zoom in, zoom out kind of thing.
Exactly.
And the chapter actually suggests that the personnel development unit should play a key role in talent management.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Working closely with the recruitment team.
To make sure that development is part of the talent strategy from the very beginning.
So it's not just about hiring someone and then figuring out how to develop them later.
Right. It's about thinking about development from day one.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's also worth noting that the chapter mentions a study from 2020.
Okay. Recent.
Yeah. The Kienbaum Talent Management Study.
Kienbaum. Okay.
And this study raised some questions about whether HR is really doing enough in terms of talent management.
Oh, so it's a bit of a wake-up call.
It is. It suggests that organizations need to take a hard look at their current practices and see if they're truly maximizing their talent potential.
That's a good reminder for all of us.
So then the chapter shifts gears again and dives into an area that's super important but can sometimes get overlooked.
Which is?
legal frameworks.
The legal stuff.
Yeah, and specifically co-determination.
Co-determination, right.
Which basically means employee involvement in decision-making.
Okay, so this is about giving employees a voice.
Exactly. And the chapter focuses on the rights and responsibilities of the Works Council.
The Works Council, yeah.
Which is an employee representative body that exists in many countries.
So it's like a mini union within the company.
Yeah, and they have a lot of power when it comes to vocational training and development.
Like what kind of power?
Well, they have the right to be involved in decisions about all sorts of things related to training.
Okay, like what specifically?
Like who gets to be a trainer, both appointing and removing them.
So they have a say in who's leading the training.
And who gets selected to participate in training programs, especially when the company is paying for it and giving employees time off to attend?
Makes sense. They want to make sure the training is fair and accessible to everyone.
Right.
They also have a say in the scope of the training. Like what knowledge should be imparted.
So they're involved in the curriculum design.
And the specific content of the training programs, where they take place, how long they last, even the scheduling.
Wow, so they have a lot of control over the logistics.
They do, and the chapter points out that this level of co-determination is really specific to vocational training.
So it's not like this for every decision in the company.
No, it's a special case because training is seen as so crucial for employees' future prospects.
It makes sense that they would have more say in something that directly affects their careers.
And if the company and the Works Council can't agree on something related to training?
Oh, what happens then?
The Works Council can actually take it to court.
Whoa, so they have legal recourse.
They do. It's serious business.
It shows how important these rights are.
And the co-determination also extends to how participants are chosen for training.
So like the selection process.
Exactly, including things like assessment centers and other selection tools.
They want to make sure the selection process is fair and transparent.
And even the makeup of participant groups in training programs that might be open to external applicants.
So they're involved in who gets to learn, both inside and outside the company.
The chapter also highlights this really important point.
What's that?
Which is that employers might actually be legally obligated to introduce specific qualification measures for their employees.
Oh, really? When would that happen?
If there are major changes to the workplace, work processes, or workflows.
So if things change significantly, the company might have to provide training to help employees adapt.
Exactly. Like if new technology is implemented, the company might have to train employees on how to use it.
That's really important, especially in today's rapidly changing technological landscape.
And the Works Council can actually demand that the employer take specific actions to compensate for these changes.
So they have the power to push for training and development.
They do, and this includes providing training to address those changes in job requirements.
That's a big deal. It shows that employee development isn't just a nice to have, it's a legal obligation in some cases.
The chapter really emphasizes that this particular regulation gives the Works Council a strong, absolute right of co-determination.
So they have a lot of leverage.
They do. They can demand specific training measures to help employees deal with changes.
It's all about protecting employees and making sure they have the skills they need to succeed.
And it's not just limited to one country.
Oh, so this is a broader trend.
Yeah, the chapter points out that similar regulations exist in various state-level personnel representation laws and other employee representation laws.
So it's not just a national thing, it's happening at different levels of government.
It shows that this idea of co-determination is pretty widespread.
And it makes sense, giving employees a voice in decisions that affect their work lives.
It creates a more collaborative and democratic workplace.
And ultimately, that benefits everyone, both employees and employers.
Absolutely. It's a win-win.
So where do we go from here?
The chapter then takes a look at the impact of demographics and, of course, the recent pandemic.
Two huge forces that have shaken up the world of work.
Yeah. And it starts by noting that all sorts of factors influence markets, companies, and the workforce.
It's a complex ecosystem.
It is. And before the pandemic hit, demographics were already a major driver of strategic personnel planning.
So things like an aging workforce,
yeah,
changes in birth rates, all that.
Exactly. And the chapter suggests that these demographic pressures are going to become even more significant in the post-pandemic world.
So we need to be prepared for those changes.
And then, boom, the pandemic arrives.
Yeah, everything changed overnight.
Companies had to adapt so quickly, work processes went digital almost instantly, and the focus shifted to just keeping things running.
It was a survivor mode.
Total survival mode, and the chapter makes this really important point.
What's that?
That a simple return to the old ways of working, like everyone back in the office,
right,
That's probably not going to happen.
It's the future of work. People are realizing they can be productive from anywhere.
And companies are realizing that too.
It's a win-win, as long as it's done right.
Exactly. It's about finding the right balance.
Flexibility and structure.
The chapter also raises concerns about the impact on the availability of skilled workers in certain sectors.
Oh, yeah. Like which ones?
Things like trade, food service, hospitality, those kinds of industries.
They were hit hard by the pandemic.
And it's going to take time to recover.
And we need to make sure we're investing in training and development to help people get back on their feet.
And the chapter also points out the potential for the pandemic to have a disproportionate impact on women.
Yeah. Especially in lower and middle income countries.
Where they might have had to take on more caregiving responsibilities.
It's a real concern, and we need to address it.
This whole dynamic environment, as the chapter describes it, requires HR professionals to really step up their game.
They need to be adaptable and resilient.
And they need to be able to apply new and evolving competencies.
It's a challenging time to be in HR, but also an exciting time.
Definitely, they have the opportunity to make a real difference.
You help organizations and individuals navigate these turbulent times.
The chapter suggests that all these open questions and uncertainties might explain why some organizations are hesitant to try new things.
It's easier to stick with what you know.
Especially when the future is so unclear.
But the chapter also encourages HR to be bold.
To embrace their role as ambassadors for employees.
To represent their needs and advocate for their development.
And to be proactive partners with the business units.
So not just reactive, but strategic.
And it highlights the growing importance of networking for HR.
Networking is key in any field, but especially in HR.
Especially now when everything is changing so fast.
You need to be connected to what's happening and who's doing what.
So towards the end, the chapter briefly touches on the profile and activities of a personnel development professional.
Okay, the people behind the scenes.
It acknowledges that a later chapter will go into more depth.
We'll get to that.
But it does highlight a really important challenge.
Which is?
Aligning the development needs that the company identifies.
Right.
With the often very different and subjective development aspirations of individual employees.
So the company might want one thing, but the employee might want something else.
It's a classic dilemma.
And there's no easy answer.
The chapter mentions the importance of comparing the self-image.
How employees see themselves.
The external image.
How the company sees them.
To try to find that sweet spot where everyone's needs are met.
A delicate balancing act.
And finally, this chapter gives us a little taste of the core concepts of qualification, competency, and performance.
The holy trinity of personnel development.
It notes that Chapter 2 will go into more detail, but it does mention different categories of competence.
Okay, like what?
Things like self-competence, social competence, professional competence, methodological competence.
It's breaking down the different aspects of what it means to be competent.
It's laying the groundwork for a deeper understanding of these key concepts.
So this first chapter is like a map of the territory.
It gives us an overview of the key concepts, challenges, and trends in personnel development.
And it sets the stage for a more detailed exploration in the chapters to come.
It's a great starting point for anyone who wants to understand how to develop their people effectively.
Absolutely. It's essential reading for HR professionals and anyone involved in talent management.
So I'm curious, what aspects of this chapter really resonated with you?
I think the emphasis on the digital agenda is really important, something that all organizations need to be thinking about.
Yeah, it's not just about technology. It's about how we work, how we learn, how we lead.
And the whole idea of co-determination is also really interesting. It's a model that more companies should consider.
Definitely. Giving employees a voice in their development is crucial.
And I think the chapter does a good job of highlighting the challenges and opportunities that HR faces in today's complex world.
It's a call to action, really.
And step up and be strategic partners in driving organizational success.
Absolutely. And I'm excited to see what the next chapter has in store.
Me too. We'll dive.
All right, let's do it.
Click forward.
To chapter 2.
To this next level.
See you there.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks.